guys. It's June 17th, 2019, and this is your episode 152 of At Percussion. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi, and with me, as usual, are Laurel Black.
Hi.
And Ben Charles is here.
Hi, everybody.
And again, guest hosting with us is Caleb Pickering.
Can't get rid of me.
You're back for more. That's good. Well, you guys, our guest today is a very active performer and educator. She performs with the Concordia Foundation and works extensively with their educational program, playing an integral part in the children's productions and workshops. Laurel and I met her because she also runs literally the largest percussion retailer in the United Kingdom. So they deal instruments, sticks, mallets, sheet music, etc. You may have heard of them, especially if you're on that side of the world, called Southern Percussion. They're located in Southeast England in Essex, just about an hour outside of London. And she's been a great business associate of ours and dealing our publications since, I looked it up, Katie, since 2010 was our first email correspondence that I could find. And she's just been wonderful to work with and totally great company to be with and be associated with. So how's it going, Katie Ellman?
Thanks for the intro. Wow. It's good. Nice to be on here. Thank you.
Bye. Yeah, you're very welcome. What's happening over there for you right now? I see you're in your shop.
Yeah, well, it's Father's Day over here as well. So we've just literally been chilling, relaxing, having a barbecue and everything, and put the little one to bed, and now here with you guys. Nice relaxed day.
Well, Katie, how is business? That's a really tacky question to ask, probably.
Oh, business is good. We're growing all the time and, you know, just dealing with more instruments and not more products, and this place is kind of getting a lot too small, and next year we're doubling in size, the premises.
Wow.
And so we're going to have, I mean, we normally have a couple of 5 octaves here and a couple of different rimbas and vibes for people to test and have an instrument and swamp stuff and everything everywhere. And it's just, there's too much stuff going on and it's time to get bigger. So it's good.
That sounds very good. So, spoiler alert, you're very young and you're the director of this whole company. Is that right?
So it's actually our 10-year anniversary this year. So I was, even younger. I'm not that young anymore. But when I started it and took it over from someone, it was a really small company. And he was retiring, and it was just run from a shed in his back garden. And he kind of said to me, will I take it over? And at the time, I didn't know what I was doing. So I was like, Mom, Dad, come help me. And they kind of, we went down in a van and kind of picked up the company. And here it is. It's good. It's growing. It's getting bigger and more staff now. And yeah, it's good. And it's difficult being a female and a young female in the industry at times, but I've never really let that bother me, and just I need it to my advantage, let people think that I'm young and naive and they can help me and I learn so much more.
I use that to my advantage too. what is being the director entail, just in some words?
A lot of work. I mean, it's that's probably the first thing. I mean, now it's getting easier to, you know, you can delegate some things, but it's not only you, but it takes some organization and just, it's deciding all the brands and how we build up the company is that by being a player myself, we only ever sell things here that I would play or use myself. And if I go and I try something and I don't actually like it, or I don't like the feel of that instrument, or it's not that good, then I won't sell the brand or I won't sell the instrument, because if people buy something from me and they're not that happy on it, then why should they trust me and come back to it again? So I've kind of used my playing and my knowledge of instruments and wanted to get further and know things, and I visited all the factories that we sell and learn how they're all made, so I can then go on and really kind of tell people what everything about it that I possibly can.
Do you carry the music of Caleb Pickering?
If you do, it's the Allen.
Sorry?
The Allen publication.
That's right. Oh, you do. Hear that, Caleb? You're validated.
Yeah, check that out. I was going to grab it for you and do a little promo.
It must be good then. That's great. Well, speaking of carrying people's music, a question I hear from young people a lot who are publishing, of course, we all know a lot of percussionists are self-publishing, or they're just publishing and they're published by companies like Cielan or Tapspace, Roloff, pick whichever one you like. A lot of them ask, how do I get my music to be carried by a retailer like Steve Weiss Music or Southern Percussion? What advice would you give to those people?
To be really honest, if you're starting out, how we end up with music and new publishers and new composers is either two ways. One, someone's asking for the music, so we then have to go ourselves and kind of find it and contact the publisher, contact the composer and say, hey, we've had a request for your music. Can we please order some copies, and what else do you have? You know, for shipping wise, it makes more sense to bring in a couple of pieces. Or the other option is just send a copy to me that I can't, then it's here in my shop. Don't write promo and I go, okay, I've got a copy here. This is the price they're wanting to sell it for. Let's add it to the website. See if there's any interest. Then if there's some interest out there, then we'll sell that one copy. And then we're going to go, okay, well, I need to buy some more in because I've sold that one. More people are going to want it. So what I say is just pay the money for the postage. Get it on, send it out there with a letter saying the price, maybe a little description, there isn't one, and a little bit about you. And that's the easiest way to do it, because I don't want more music floating around the shop that's not on the system. It's far easier for me to spend the time or get someone to add it to the system and put it away.
But do you think people will... So let's say I'm a new composer, my music isn't circulating, it's not selling. Do you think just being in the store alone will make it sell? Or do you think that we have to do more?
I mean, the greatest thing at the moment is that you've got Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and all these things out there that you can do. And if you're a player yourself, record it. Get it onto Facebook, get it onto these places. Look, just do some research, because then you'll know there's marimba pages, there's certainly on Facebook, there's so many different groups for percussion that just get there, put it in there, tag it. You know, that's the easiest thing to do is say, do a post, you go through, for instance, you see that we add it to our website, then put a video on Facebook, video on YouTube saying, hey, check out this music, and it's available from Southern Percussion. Of course, and we're going to share that on our multimedia channels. We're going to do all that because we're like, someone's, you know, linking through to us, someone's advertising us. And then you're going to go through, and it's that kind of circle of being able to help things that, you know, shops are going to help you if you help them. And it's always the way through, whether it be mallets or anything. The more you can do proactively to help yourself is the best thing, because I'm not going to, if you're no one who's heard of you or no one's requesting your music, I'm not going to spend the money as a shop buying your music.
Right. Well, and that's why I ask, and I, of course, I already kind of knew this answer, but I wanted everyone to hear it from you, because so often people think, okay, if I can just have it published or if I can just have it in the shop, it's going to, like, the shop will sell it for me. And it's like, well, yes, of course, they'll facilitate selling it, but they're not going to push it for you. Yeah.
We have over 20,000 different pieces of music. Necessarily going to go, that's the one I want. Of course, we have new publications, so you're on the homepage if it's the last piece that we've added to the system to help advertise things. But at the end of the day, if someone walks in here, you're not going to know where to start with all the music and everything they want
necessarily. Right.
So recordings and videos are by far, like, the best way to do anything.
Great to hear. Okay, Ben, I'm sorry. What do you got?
Yeah, that's what I was going to get into is, like, I think that especially, you know, if you're John Smith writing a marimba solo and no one's ever heard your marimba solo, then how, like, why is anyone going to buy it? So I think it's so, so important to have good quality recordings. And like Katie said, putting, you know, you can put in your description available in the U.S. from Steve Weiss Music and Europe from, you know, so-and-so. I totally lost my train of thought with that. That was my main point.
Laura, what do you got?
Yeah. I'm curious, Katie. So I can only imagine how many things you had to learn and figure out along the way in the 10 years, and how many things you wound up learning. because you just said, you know, you add it to the website. And I was like, man, does she add it to the website? And I can only imagine the things you've learned about, like, accounting. And who knows? Yeah. I would just love to know kind of what all you've had to figure out.
I mean, it was a really difficult one when I was 20 at the time that I ended up with some percussion. I was still at college, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I was at music school my whole life, and then I went on to music college. You don't have to, in England, you need like 2 F's to get into music college. It doesn't matter, like, really how good you are at academics or not. It's all just about playing and performance. So I didn't really maybe work as hard as I should have done at school. So business-wise and that kind of thing, I didn't really have any idea. I was just a percussionist who was like, okay, let's go into business now and see what happens. And we took it on. I started with the sheet music, continued because it was just sheet music at the beginning. And then after about 2 years of doing that, then I was finding out that the Mike Bolter distribution for the UK was up for grabs. So I just started kind of dabbling a little bit on mallets. And I had at the time been playing Mike Bolter mallets, and I was like, okay, let's send them an email. And in all honesty, my dad helped me with the email. My dad's a chartered accountant. So I was really lucky that from the word go, I had someone to kind of financially at the back of my head going like, yeah, be a little bit careful there, we'll do this. And wrote a really formal letter to the people who dealt with Mike Bolter Exports. And they sent me a message. I sent them a message about 10 o'clock at night. They responded at 11 o'clock that night, saying, okay, we'll see you, but we'll see you at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning in London. And I was like, okay, what do I do? What do I say? Like, I'm kind of not really prepared for anything. I've just sent a really formal business email that wasn't even me. So I kind of went there, and they'll say this story. They loved kind of when we talk about this back now, how things have changed. But I kind of went there and went, okay, well, I know these six. Let's talk about the six, what I like, what I don't like, what I think sell more, what things could happen. And I was just honest. And I said, okay, I don't know numbers, but they, of course, don't talk numbers with you at the beginning. And then kind of a couple of days later, I won the Mike Bolter distribution for the UK and was like, okay, well, maybe I can actually do this by knowing what I know. And then building it up from there, you know, you have the differences that next came Marimba One and I flew over to America. And in that situation, I was in a boardroom, a big boardroom with a massive table in front of me and them on one side and me on the other. And they were like, right, let's talk numbers. Let's do this. And I was like, had a calculator there and I was like, okay. And it was just being thrown in the deep end, actually. Just made it was kind of I was either gonna sink or I was gonna swim, and luckily I've always been one of those things that I can't not succeed. I have to just no matter what I'm gonna go for it and put everything I can like into it, and thankfully I think well so far it's working out. I hope it continues. But as far as it goes with the website and everything, until I think 2 years ago, absolutely everything was just me. So I did this whole entire company on my own. So
that's
when you
crazy.
Saw the website, the new thing on, like, I'm very good at still not very good at Facebook and all those kind of bits, but kind of product added to the website, images on the website, pictures, it was all me, everything. And that's what you kind of, I was working till 2 o'clock at night. I was still performing until 5 years ago. I was gigging 4 nights a week as well on a tour. So I kind of had, I don't know how I did it all. I think there was a lot of caffeine involved, but yeah, just play for it.
Wow. It seems like you always hear about that little time period with anyone successful where they had this window of years that was just totally freaking insane, like wall-to-wall busy, and they get through it and there's sunshine on the other end. And yeah, what do you got, Caleb?
Yeah, I think it's just really cool. This is another person that's come up that they might not have had the traditional training for what they went into, like Casey with you and your video editing. And it's just kind of cool to get and see. It's just people like getting there. They didn't like have all these special like years of MBAs or whatever. It was just figuring it out as you go and just like learning the skill set. I just think it's really cool to to see yet again another.
Yeah, you're exactly right, and we see those people over and over and over. And yeah, Katie's another one.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, like Caleb mentioned, video editing. I think it's so true that every single time you edit video or do a business transaction or anything like that, like you learn so many new skills, and you just they just go in your back pocket. And you can use them the next time. I just think about the most two recent videos that I edited, and there were skills on the first video that I figured out that I didn't even know I would need on the second video. But then, yeah, that was very applicable, and I'm sure the same is going with business deals. I can't imagine flying to America to meet with Marimba One for business, having never really done all that much business.
But after having Ron on the podcast, I can kind of imagine. Yes. It's like, oh, dude, this guy, like Katie said, the boardroom, and I imagined, oh, yeah, what, there's like a bunch of Marimba bars everywhere, a bunch of boards, what? It's probably really laid back.
No, you know what, yes, I remember after that day, yeah, completely, and I remember when I feel that we actually had like a really big earthquake at the time as well, that was like the most terrible. So I kind of had like a couple of firsts, and that kind of that trip was absolutely crazy and we'll never forget. But it was that first day, I think, I even think that we kind of came off the plane and then near enough straight into this, and they kind of just drilled me for like a day, and then we're like, yeah, cool, now on to the rest of it, you know, and then all the fun began. So I think maybe a little bit of a, you know, fun and games to see whether I kind of could hold my ground or not. But Ron can he can do business like you if you need be.
I missed that. Say it one more time. Ron is.
Ron can be business like if he needs to be.
Oh right, gotcha. Of course. Well, then I'm a little insulted because this podcast is all business, and he was way laid back. It's totally business. What you got, Ben?
So I had a question. We're talking about all this like trial by fire sort of stuff, and obviously that's the main way you learn this, but and it sounds like you had your father was sort of in business to a certain extent, so you got some advice from him. Were there any books that you read?
I'm not much of a reader. I still even now, well, rightly or wrongly, don't really do the whole like business, would never think about going through a business course or a business degree. I mean, I did UKTI, like kind of government scheme to do with I think a business or something about expanding a company and going into different territories. But other than that, no, I just, if something goes horribly wrong, then I'll fix it and just keep going and trying, and don't think so far anything's gone hugely wrong. So I'm just lucky.
Cool.
Well, you're already doing it, so it seems like you don't need to go to the schools or anything.
I'm sure I'll mess up big time at some point soon.
Well, guys, let's give Katie just a little break. You know, and I thought of this because Ben mentioned video editing, and I have put a little sound together for you guys. So this has nothing to do with Southern Percussion or Katie, but it's a
DuckTales theme.
Oh, that was fun. That was some hard work I had to do. But this one is a sound that you might hear, and this is going to be just too easy for you guys. You guys are going to get this. This is a sound that we hear, yeah, in Australia. So here you go. All right, any idea?
I didn't really get
Caleb
it.
Caleb did
a little gesture, and I think I know what it is. Caleb, why don't you say it?
I was just practicing my lasso from Texas. But is it bull roar?
Laurel, we got him. Laurel, you want to tell him what it really is?
I wasn't going to. It's a weed eater.
Yeah, it's a weed whacker.
Weed whacker?
Yeah, so no, I knew you would get this, so I did some editing, and I took the sound of a weed whacker and tried to mimic the sound of a bull roar. But you're absolutely right, the real thing is bull roar, and here's a real bull roar for you, instead of a weed whacker. It's good, so now you're laughing. Here's the weed eater one more time. In your defense, I did manipulate it to sound like a bull roar. It took way too much time. But yeah, through clever audio editing, I did mess with the pitch and the volumes and try to make it sound like that a little bit.
And by too much time, he means like 3 or 4 hours.
It didn't take that long. It did take too long. I mean, 30 minutes is too long, but it did. Yeah.
It was several hours.
I don't know if it was several hours.
Yes.
Did you sample your own feedback?
No, so I downloaded from YouTube. I sampled from this video 2 hours of Weed Whacker sound. Something.
What's that on YouTube?
I don't know. There's a lot of that on YouTube. A lot of weird, just like 2 hours of airplane ambient sound, 2 hours of Weed Whacker. So, anyway, I used what's called elastic pitch modifier, and so brought all the levels of the sound down. And I even took screenshots for you. So what you're looking at is something, a little plugin in Samplitude called Elastic Audio Editor. And the orange line is pitch. So you guys know it's real easy to adjust pitch of a wave sound. But this is great because it lets you draw the pitch level wherever you want it to be. And so I just kind of made a zigzag up and down to make it sound like a weed eater. Because the problem is a weed eater is just like, the sound is just straight, the pitch is too consistent. Whereas a bull roar, the pitch goes up and down and the volume goes in and out. So let me just tell you guys what a bull roar is exactly for those of you who don't know. So commonly known as a bull roar, but can also be called a turndun, a rhombi or a rhombus, dates back to 17 or 18,000 BC in Ukraine, depending on what you read. I saw both numbers. So it's a little rectangle, usually kind of arrow-shaped piece of wood or stone or bone, usually wood, though. It's about 6 inches all the way up to 2 feet long and about 2 or so inches wide. And like I said, it's like a blade or propeller that's attached to a thin piece of rope, and it's swung either over your head or at your side. And of course, what's happening is the blade spins so rapidly through the air that it flips around wildly and makes this really unique and makes this unique, cool sound. We think of them as Australian. Do you guys know why Australia comes to mind when we think of this instrument?
No.
Do you know who Paul Hogan is? I have a feeling Caleb does.
Is that like Hogan's Heroes, Paul Hogan?
Paul Hogan from like That's a Knife.
Well, that's it. Yeah, that's Crocodile Dundee. Yeah, so anyway, Crocodile Dundee was like huge when I was a kid, and I loved Crocodile Dundee, and that was probably the first time I ever saw this instrument or heard this instrument. I imagine a lot of other people the same. So, of course, we think, yeah, okay, this is an authentic Australian Aborigine instrument, but actually it's found a lot more places. So a lot of cultures have this instrument or some variation of the bull roar. The Maori culture in New Zealand, bull roars are made from wood, stone, or bone, and are used for healing or making rain. The Dogon people of Mali in South Africa use bull roars as ancestral voices and for ceremonies. In the Americas, both south, north, cultures all the way from Amazon up to the Inuits in the far, far north have their variations of bull roars. They're in ancient Greece. The bull roar was called the rhombus, which literally means whirling or rumbling. Of course, this is named after that sound, but also its close resemblance to the rhombus, which is the triangle in geometry, the diamond shape in Euclidean geometry. Bull roars were used in the cult of the Greek god Cybele. You see them in Britain and Ireland as well, ceremonies and also toys. Parts of Scotland refer to them as the thunder spell, and you'll actually see it as something called a thunder, I think it's a thunder stick in this book, which is Contemporary Percussion by Reginald Brindle. And that's pretty useful because there is a Henry Cowell piece that calls for 2 bull roars, and I guess he calls them thunder sticks in it, and that must come from Scotland, where they call them known as the thunder spell. In Scandinavia, dating back to the Stone Age, bull roar is called brummer in Scandinavia, and of course, Aboriginal culture culture, and it has all sorts of meanings and has a lot to do with male versus female ceremonies and spells and symbolism. Bull roars were considered secret men's business by some Aboriginal tribal groups and hence forbidden for women, children, non-initiated men, and outsiders to even hear. Some further reading, there's some great references listed on Wikipedia, and the most comprehensive article I found online that was at least free was something called Tribal Initiations and Secret Societies by Edwin Loeb, University of California Publications, all the way back in 1929. So I mentioned Henry Cowell. He's got a piece for two violins, viola, two cellos, and two bull roarers, but he calls them thundersticks. And also someone named John Antill, his ballet called Corroboree. So that's not George Antill, but John Antill, which I guess is, he's a famous Australian composer. And this piece is really cool. It's a 40 or so minute ballet. And man, if you, like probably everyone, you like The Rite of Spring and you just wish it was, say, 40 minutes longer, you totally need to listen to this piece because it is so close to Stravinsky. And I've got just a little taste of it for you here. I found where the bull roars are played. So those are a few uses in music of bull roarers. Do you guys know of any others? Caleb, I know Dean Gronemeyer has a piece that uses one. Is that right?
He does. I think it's just added in at the end. I do remember, I can't remember what it was. I do remember seeing Brian Zader, Chris Dean, and John Lane do a piece. Ben probably knows what it is. All I remember is that Chris Dean's bull roar broke and like flew across the concert hall, and we just had to stifle laughter for like the next 3 minutes until we all got through it.
I don't remember the like what piece that was, but I can like, I can picture it, and I've seen people do it both above their head and like in front of them, like vertically. But I just had a couple of things to add. One is just percussion terminology. Do not get bull roarer confused with lion's roar, which is a totally different instrument. A lion's roar is basically like a jumbo-sized cuica, and you use this in third construction. John Cage used it, I think, in several works, and you see it some other places. But so basically you have like a, like imagine like a, maybe a marching bass drum size with a either a string or a dowel through the head, and you play it by putting rosin on that and dragging like a wet cloth across, and it gets sort of, it sounds sort of like a, I don't know, like a lion's roar or something. but yeah, two totally different instruments. But I was going to bring up, so when I was a graduate student at Illinois, I played a small chamber piece, and my setup had chimes in it, and I also had to play bull roar, which if you can think about the mechanics of standing next to a set of vertical chimes trying to spin a bull roar around your head, it does not work very well. But Bill Mersch gave me a very exotic bull roar replacement, and I just Googled to try and find the name of it, and I found it's either, it seems like the same instrument, just different names, buzzing bow or wind wand, and there is actually double wind wand. But basically, it's like a lightweight wooden frame, and it's like, imagine almost like a big ratchet, like that, it'll spin around like that. And you attach like a one of those like huge like jumbo rubber bands to it. And I think that if you ever have to play a bull roar, that's, I mean, it's not quote unquote authentic, but it's a lot easier to control. You get a much more constant sound, and you don't risk the Christopher Dean's bull roar flying off.
Killing somebody, yeah.
Described. But yeah, like I said, I played that one piece that had bull roar, and that's my only bull roaring experience so far.
There is one. I saw a YouTube video of one like you're describing. It's short. It has these rubber bands. I think they called it like a double bull roar or double wind wand or
Something. I found double wind wand online, yeah.
And it does seem really, really easy to play. It doesn't quite sound the same to me.
Yeah, it seems like it's more of a constant hum, whereas a bull roar, I guess because it's traveling so far, it has more of like a Doppler effect to it.
Doppler effect, yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, you said don't confuse it for a lion's roar, and also don't confuse it for a boron, like the drum from Ireland.
Yeah,
because they're... Yeah, sound very much the same as far as the...
If you're confused about these and need to order any of them, contact Southern Percussion.
Right, Katie carries all this stuff. She'll answer all your questions about all of this.
They're doubling their space just for their bull roar inventory.
Yeah, you know, people are going to start this now, aren't they? I'm going to get how many emails going, oh, so where can I get one? And we'll be like, oh, crap, I need to start looking up some things.
Well, the problem is someone will say bull roar, someone will say buzzing stick, someone will say thunder stick.
Somebody told me these, or the lion's roar would be very upset when the wrong thing arrives.
We better just bag this. I better just bag this segment. Yeah. It's a nightmare. So have you guys had to play bull roar before? I found it to be, I've only played it a couple of times, but I find them to be either challenging and taking a lot of strength or just very easy.
Yeah, mostly just annoying, yeah.
It's going after you get it going, it's not a big deal, but like the first couple of swings are always the to get it turning a little bit,
right?
Yeah,
to get
it's like when you have to play wine glass is another one, like god, I hope this works,
right? To get it spinning. But I find like once it is spinning, man, it's a workout. Like there's so much air resistance to get that sound really happening.
We use rulers, like the plastic see-through rulers,
and that works.
Pulling them, yeah, works fine.
Oh, cool.
It's harder to get started, but it's way easier because, I mean, it weighs nothing.
Yeah, it's way light. I bet the pitch is pretty steady and high-pitched, right?
I can't remember. It's been too long.
So, Katie, all jokes aside, speaking of unusual instruments, obviously as a percussion retailer, you want to carry standard sticks, mallets, drums, that sort of thing that you know you're going to sell. But do you stock any, like, unusual instruments that you, like, that are, like, ordered more often than you might think or anything like that? Is there any peculiar things that come up in inventory, or what are some of the more peculiar requests that you've had to research?
We try and keep like to make sure everything's a mallet wise and some of the unusual mallets. Generally, if we're a distributor or retailer of something, we try to keep everything in, so you do get some weird ones with them. I mean, one of the strangest ones is that we sell quite a few of is, what's it called? It's from Milo, and it's the cricket sound effect.
Yeah.
That we sell so many of those things. And you're like, okay, how many people are going to need this sound and are needing for it? And you always kind of have to wonder what it is that they're doing with them and for what effect they're doing. So that's kind of probably on a day-to-day basis one of the strangest ones, I have to say, that I don't really get why somebody go out.
So that reminds me, here a few weeks ago a few months ago at this point, I was walking by our like the business office in our fine arts center, and our business manager was like, oh, I have a package in for you. I was like, okay, I didn't order anything, and it was a box from Majestic Percussion. I was like, this is unusual, I don't think. And it was from Lone Star Percussion. I was like, yeah. I don't think I ordered anything from Majestic. And I was like, maybe Casey had them send me something. And I opened it up.
Yeah, yeah, right.
It was a set of Majestic dinner chimes. And I was like, what on earth? Like, maybe the Wind Ensemble needs these or something. And they didn't. No one knew what it was. And so we finally checked what credit card had ordered it. And it was for our, we have an ROTC program, like a military program here. And they use it for some function. And they had ordered it, but like it was weird because when I think Majestic, I don't think of like quirky little sort of dinner chimes. It's not something that I would think of the marimba company making. So yeah, just a little recent experience I had with that.
You'd be surprised, I think, some of the companies that you get like random little things from some of the companies, and you do wonder why it's come from that. A lot of things make sense, but yeah, you'd be surprised how many there's like little quirky things that go with company.
Well, marimbas are pretty new for Majestic. They've been making timpani and drums and tom-toms for much longer, for sure. Yeah, the marimba is not too many years in yet.
So I've got a little summary and kind of just a personal share about one of my favorite books that I learned about from my old teacher, Tim Jones, who is an Australian, but he learned, I guess it's not video, but it's called Performing in the Zone by John Gorry. This G-O-R-R-I-E, if you ever want to look it up. He's in Norway now. He's a trumpet player. He's actually New Zealand born. But he wrote this a few years after he wrote a pretty prolific article on focal dystonia and recovery, because he had that with his embouchure. I don't know all what that involves. I just know it really injures your ability to use your muscles like that. But he wrote this book, Performing in the Zone, which basically covers what we label as performance anxiety. I'll just go ahead and say it now so Ben gets all his jokes out of the way. He uses the term performance arousal. So I'm going to be using the word arousal a lot. So if everyone can just keep a happy face on, that'll be fine.
We're going to be real mature about this.
This, from history, I figure that's what's going to happen. Yeah.
Nobody look at the chat.
It's covered. So it's published in 2009. But what's really cool is it aims just for public performance in general. So that could be musician, actor, anyone that just does public speaking, dancers, as far as people that are maybe ahead of a company. Oh, Katie, funny enough. Even athletes. So it's called Performing in the Zone, and basically this concept is kind of intangible. The concept of the zone, as he calls it, is... it's also referred to as flow by some people, or being centered in some philosophies. There's a thousand different names for it, but it's all kind of the same idea. So for him, the zone is this ideal place, this state of mind where performing, he says, is easy and comfortable, where your actions are efficient and effortless, and when your results are up to or even exceed your previous expectations. And even brings up that a lot of us probably have felt this with, say, a solo piece that you know really well, maybe something you've been playing for years and years and years, and you know all the notes, and maybe some of them have changed, or maybe you have like a deep connection to it, just something you've performed a lot that you can pull out any day of the year and you're good to go. So it's a book basically on performance psychology. And the premise is around this idea of performance arousal, which is basically taking that nervous energy, that performance energy, and framing it in a more positive connotation. So if you have anxiety, that's the negative. If you have this performance energy, performance arousal, that's the positive. So what he does is he kind of gives you a five to five scale. So if you think... if we're sitting at zero on a number scale, that's just where we are right now. So maybe we're all calm, rested. We're not really high stress, high pressure. It goes all the way up to positive five. So positive one, two, three, four, five. Five is like peak excitement. So like a professional athlete, like a professional football player, but hopefully when they're about to go play, they're at that positive five, like as much hype as they can get. And then all the way down to negative five, which is like debilitating panic attack. So he says negative five, a good example is, say you fall into a cage at the zoo and you realize you're about to be eaten by lion, tiger, oh my. That's like negative five. You can't get any more panic than that. So it's really interesting. What he does is basically he gives you all these techniques that channel this performance energy into the correct amount of performance arousal. So someone that's perfectly rested, so maybe right now all four of you are at zero, but since I'm the one talking, maybe I'm at plus one, right? Performance arousal. So right now, if I were at plus four on this performance arousal chart, I would probably be stuttering a lot, like tripping over my words, like sweating, you know, all the anxiety stuff. Too much, I guess that would actually, sorry, be negative four. Positive four was if I thought this was like the most groundbreaking thing that has ever been birthed into mankind, something like that. So he says public speaking, maybe plus two or three, maybe a modern dancer, someone in ballet might want positive four because it's more physical. So basically he gives you this idea to visualize where your performance arousal and anxiety's energies are. And the idea is every time you practice, perform, anything like that, you journal it. And so you have this data, these plus negative five to positive five data points you can look back over and just see what's going on in your head, basically. So that's kind of the first part of the book, is he just explains the system. And then the best part, honestly, is the next, which is 26 techniques he provides. So he basically gives 26 techniques, tongue twister, to basically either calm yourself down, some of them kind of psych you up. But basically, it's this whole idea of giving your head something to do. So normally when you get nervous, you get anxious, it's because you have that inner monologue that's distracting you and pulling your attention elsewhere. So these are all 26 different techniques, some of them that are done like in the moment, like mid-performance, and some that are preparatory, some that you do after. But they're all aimed to get rid of that inner monologue that's distracting and negative. So what I like about these techniques is they are far more in-depth than your classic 26 BuzzFeed article of 26 ways to whatever.
It's better than BuzzFeed.
Yeah, it's better than BuzzFeed. But it goes from simple breathing exercises like the, you know, inhale for this many counts, hold it, exhale for that many counts, do it again. It goes all the way to talking about how to adjust your speaking voice just in your day-to-day to find the most centered pitch reference for yourself. So that before performance, you have that pitch and that timbre internalized, and you just read out loud and you bring it back down to your calm, steady talking. And then it gets as in-depth as some, personally, my favorite one, I think, is called Going Peripheral. And it's talking about your peripheral vision. But basically, he says, and you see it in nature documentaries or nervous performers, they'll get that tunnel vision where they don't look left or right. They're just... You're centered on what you think is the threat that's at hand. So animals, if you're about to get eaten, you're probably not going to be looking at the butterflies and the trees floating around, probably just focused on whatever's eating you. But it goes as far as to, he brings up this tunnel vision that's immediately in front of you. And if you ever feel it coming on, he gives you ways. One of them is to just simply look to the left or the right. And that basically tells your mind that, okay, whatever is in front of him or her is not a threat because they've broken their tunnel vision. So just by doing these simple things, your body kind of resets itself. Your parasympathetic nervous system, it's a fancy word, basically it stops, it slows down. So it kind of brings you back to calm and centered. But it's really, I think it's a really great book. Tim Jones at UNLV Las Vegas, the year before I got here, he had the whole percussion studio. At the end of this is a 12-week program. You go week by week. And they had all, I think, 20, 25 students do it. And it was all positive results. Like, everyone saw pros in it. And there's a great percussive article. I'm not sure what month or what year it is in. You could very easily Google it. But it's really cool because it also pairs nicely with, I'm sure you've all heard of The Inner Game of Tennis.
Right.
Tim Galloway's book. It actually pairs really well with his second book. I think it's the second. It's The Inner Game of Golf.
Oh, right.
Actually, golf is way hard to find, but The Inner Game of Golf is better than The Inner Game of Tennis.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's really nice because in The Inner Game of Tennis, he comes up with these ideas. And in Inner Game of Golf, he's learning a new skill set. So some of the ideas he's come up with have changed as he's done on himself. Just another little book. But it's really cool because he gives John Gorey, Performing in the Zone, basically gives you a series of 26 techniques and a 12-week system that addresses diet, exercise, sleep habits, positive thinking, these 26 techniques, practice techniques, neuro-linguistic programming. It just runs the whole gamut. But it's a really great book. I've recommended it to so many people, and no one has ever said that it didn't help. Because even, I mean, out of 26 techniques, even if you find one that you can do mid-performance or backstage, surely one of these is going to, you know, it's going to work for you. And really, I think it's one. It's not very expensive. I think it's like $20. It's paperback. You can get it used. And for the knowledge that's in it, it's only about 200 pages, and a lot of them are charts and graphs and stuff. So to really read it, you could probably read it in a weekend or a week, weeknights.
Are there a lot of pictures in there? I need pictures.
Yeah, there's this one. Look at that. Is that a picture? It's got like a body mass index.
No, that's a graph.
Yeah. You can't do that. Here's a picture of this person doing yoga. That's good.
There we go.
Yeah. But yeah, anyways, that's about all I could say for this one. But
that's great.
For anyone, especially that has any sort of performance anxiety or feels pressure at performance, be that music or speaking, classroom speaking, anything like that, I think this is a great book because it just has, I mean, just so many different ways you can help yourself. You know, why not pick it up?
That's great, Caleb. Thanks a lot. There are so many of these books. We talked about Peak a few episodes ago. There's Inner Game of Tennis, Inner Game of Golf. People talk about the War of Art. And there's just so, so many. But I don't know. It's what do you got, Laurel?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I had never heard of the technique of using your speaking voice to calm you down. That's new to me, so I will try that. And I was curious to know about you guys, if you have experienced this or not. But as I get older, I get more anxious about performance. And it's not debilitating at all, but I'm just much more aware of it now that I'm older. I feel like when I was younger, I was just like, hell yeah. I'm just gonna do my best, and that's it. And have you guys felt the same thing?
Well, I definitely relate to what Caleb, the book says about like anxiety, like feeling good and nervous are very close. And I know I've tried to describe that before. Like you can really channel your nervousness into positive performance energy. Like I feel like fear and excitement they're very closely related. I feel like over the years I have trained myself to just feel it in the good way. And to answer your question, Laurel, it's gotten better for me. I don't know if it's only gotten better. It hasn't gotten like exponentially better. It's kind of plateaued, but overall, yeah, it feels fine. And and of course my advice to students is always, well, you just got to perform more. You got to get more comfortable in front of audience, and you got to practice doing it in front of people as much as you possibly can. But it's great to know that there's something they can do away from that too. You know, they can like, yeah, dude, read this book, read any number one of these books and start to really address and tackle this problem.
Yeah, I think that for me, it sort of did it with Casey here. When I was younger, especially, I had a lot of performance anxiety, and over the years, I've managed to turn that energy into a positive thing, and it makes me think of two thoughts. One, I remember I had a lesson with Matt Strauss, and he said, he was like, pardon the double negative, but you're never going to not get nervous. You're always going to get nervous, so you have to figure out how to turn that nervous energy into something good. And then the other one, just a sort of amusing thought, I saw Leonard Slatkin do like a conducting workshop, and he asked the players or the people in the audience, you know, do you get nervous when you go on stage? And of course, most people are, you know, not afraid to admit, yeah, like, you know, it's nerve-wracking to go on stage. And he said, why? And someone, you know, he asked one person in particular, and they said, well, you know, because I might screw up. And he said, well, like, haven't you practiced? If you've practiced, you're not going to screw up, right? And it's like, well, yeah, you're Leonard Slatkin, so it's easy for you to say that, I think. But I think most of us, yeah, there is that sort of nervous energy that we just have to learn to channel into something positive.
Yeah, for sure.
I was wondering, I find not a lot of people have this one, but does anybody have more anxiety after? Like after your performance?
No, but I've heard of that.
That's for me for sure. Like beforehand, I'm not nervous at all. But like performance is over, it's done. It's just, yeah, that's when it gets me. I don't know. I think it's just because it's like reflecting back on everything. And that's like what causes my anxiousness overall.
Guess it depends how good you played or not. Yeah. How you feel.
Say that again, Katie. I missed it.
I said, I guess it depends how good or bad you played.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course. But Caleb, do you feel that way even after playing well?
Yeah, normally.
Yeah, is it because I know I don't really enjoy so much the chat after? You know, you go out and you shake hands and you, I don't know why, I don't, and you know, usually you're getting praise, like people are telling you nice things and you're getting compliments, but there's something about that I'd rather just, you know, let's all sit down and have a drink and hang out and talk. You know what I mean? I guess small talk is kind of difficult, and small talk about a performance is even harder. You know what I mean? But it doesn't make me nervous. Yeah.
Yeah, I find that the opposite. I find that once you've done all the small talk with some of the people afterwards, it kind of gives me a chance just to breathe a little bit. And then after all that's done and the instruments all packed away and that you're doing solo things, but then I sit down with the pianist and we just talk through the whole entire concert. And then but I think if you hadn't had that space beforehand, whether you do some of the small talk and you meet the audience, it kind of gives you that sense of, you know, even if things haven't gone so well as you planned, it gives you that time to just down and know that other people enjoyed it. So I think you're always going to be too picky and too harsh on yourself if you go straight from a concert to then discussing it and analysing it afterwards. I think you've got to remember that, I think unless you're in a really unique situation, there will always be parts of the concert. If you're doing a full concert, there's always going to be bits of it that you're going to go, oh, I wish I played that bit better or not. And you've got to learn to, as much as you're only as good as your last performance, you've also got to remember that people don't necessarily expect to be 100% perfect. And it's nice to hear that the people in the audience enjoyed it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you're absolutely right. And I don't want to sound like, man, I'm ungrateful for compliments or the small talk, because it should be a nice thing. And I guess it is a nice thing. I guess it's just there's that, you have that really thin layer. When you meet someone new, you have to get through that thin layer of surface level conversation until you feel comfortable. But I guess I just want to get to that comfortable place, you know. And we all do art and we all do music because we're trying to elevate our thinking. And like they say, you know, it's art supposed to teach us more about ourselves as humans, yada, 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 all that great stuff. And you can never do that at the surface level conversation. It's only like, you know, in fact, I could give you an example. Last week I was with Morris Palter and Bill Kahn, which you guys heard back on episode 100, and I think it was 149. And man, like, it was just so great to peel away those layers with Bill Kahn. You know, we've had Bill Kahn on the podcast before, but seeing him one-on-one and going on a hike together, and you just, yeah, getting past all that small talk is just great. And I guess I never look forward to, like, oh, dang it, we're not going to get through these layers, and I wish we would. Because you can't. You don't have time. It's not practical. These people want to say, hey, nice job, enjoyed your concert, and they want to say stuff like, what was that thing you hit? That thing? Oh, yeah, it was a bull roar. Okay. And, you know, and it's like, oh, man, I just want to get to the good stuff. I want to get elevated. You know, I want us to elevate each other in our thinking. So something I wanted to ask Katie, I wonder if you've seen with your work any trends with sheet music sale. I know a few weeks ago I reported on a piece that actually Southern Percussion carries, and it's this little snare drum solo by Richard E. Rogers Jr. called Flamboyant, and I reported on it because it's something that I don't see people playing anymore. Maybe they're playing it over there more, but it was something I was assigned as a student, so it's not too long ago. And it's just amazing to me that it made it all the way over from the East Coast, the U.S., to the West Coast, where I grew up in Utah. And my teacher assigned it to me. I played it. It was a known piece. And yet it's kind of fallen into obscurity. I don't see a single YouTube recording. None of my students had heard of it. I ask around. People haven't heard of it. It's like, man, how can this piece of music that was so known now be so forgotten? I just wonder if you see things like trends in sales or ups and downs and have any insight to why that might be.
Yeah, it always seems to be the way there's sudden ones on pieces of music. I mean, the last one in the last week has been Eric Sambre on the Doll, which is, you know, you go through and you all of a sudden sell 30 copies of something in the space of a day or 2 days, and then you'll get nothing for months to come. And I think that quite often it will depend if there's a competition being announced, or, I mean, over with you guys, I think you have state competitions and different things like that that roll off kind of carry with ensemble music and different things. So you get ones like that. But also, yeah, I mean, also the other option is that someone's done a post on Facebook or something and done a recording. It's amazing how that can trend it off as well. So, and then it gets shared loads of times, and then everyone who shared it then wants to view it again and wants to then buy the music. And that's why it always helps when you've got links and stuff, when you're going to do a video thing, and to kind of say where things get from, if certainly you're the composer. That's always a, it's always a nice thing to do. And it also works.
Yeah. Well, you guys, thanks so much. This was really great. And Katie Ellman, thanks so much for joining us. And just congratulations with everything you're doing with Southern Percussion. You guys are just totally doing great.
Thanks for having me as well.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Well, Laurel, Ben, Caleb, thanks a bunch. And we'll catch you guys on one.